living and teaching in Sri Lanka as an Anagarika myself, I was invited to give a talk at a particular vihara where Ananda Metta had taught. And not thinking much about this, I went to this place, and it was as if Bante was sitting in the room somewhere. It was unmistakably Bante, quite strange. So it's just a very odd experience of mine. So yes, you learnt that he was born in Tooting, of all places. Yeah, so I'm going to be speaking about him and about his time in India after his arrival in Kalimpong, which is a small town in northeast India on the borders of what is now Sikkim. It used to be part of Sikkim, actually. You learnt last week of Bante being conscripted, and eventually, at the end of the war, the end of the war having been declared, walking out of the barracks and never returning. You learnt of his going forth as a homeless wanderer, dressed in the traditional manner, in earth-dyed cloth. You learnt of his companion, the Bengali Brahmin called Banerjee, and how they were refused entry to Sri Lanka because they'd destroyed their identification papers, because of course as full-time followers of the Dharma, they were supposed to have relinquished their identity, their old identity, but to their disappointment, they were refused entry and went elsewhere. In fact, they began to walk from South India northwards. You learnt of these two companions sitting at the feet of their Hindu gurus, and eventually going forth as Dharmapriya, as Bante called himself, and as Satyapriya, as Banerjee had been named by Ananda Mayi Ma, one of the female gurus at whose feet they sat. Then eventually they reached Saranath, hoping for ordination. Saranath, of course, is where the Buddha is supposed to have communicated the Dharma to his five erstwhile ascetic companions, of whom one was Asrajit. And to their great disappointment, the bhikkhus there refused. Bitterly disappointed, they leave for Benares. And suddenly, Satyapriya remembers that amongst the Saranath bhikkhus there was talk of a man by the name of Chandramani, who was teaching, Jagdish Kashyap, who was teaching at Benares Hindu University. And maybe Satyapriya thinks that he will be able to help them. So they walk to the university, and they locate very easily the venerable Jagdish Kashyap, a very portly monk who Bante is immediately impressed with by his bright, intelligent eyes and his friendly demeanour, quite different from the monks at Saranath. And he advises them that there is a monk, a very elderly monk called Chandramani, living at Kusinara, who may ordain them, may give them ordination. So this is what happens. So at first Bante is named Dharmarakshita, very soon afterwards, I think, you know, Chandramani must have been a little bit forgetful. Somebody tells him, well, you know, this won't do because we can't have two Dhammarakshitas. So the old man, you know, rather sort of with a gesture of good-humoured impatience, as Bhante says, all right, let him be Sangharakshita. So in that way he was called Sangharakshita, protected by the Dharma, or the protector of the Dharma. It can be read both ways. That is the name by which he was known. That's his ordained name. Then they return to Sarnath. Satchapriya decides to go to Ceylon, and Bhante, now Shramanera Sangharakshita, remains under the care of Jagdish Kashyap, Venerable Jagdish Kashyap. For the best part of a year, Bhante remains with Kashyapji, studying Pali, Abhidhamma, and logic. And apparently he really enjoyed logic, and while studying it was often heard by Kashyapji to burst into laughter. So apparently the study of logic can occasion laughter. Then in 1950, Jagdish Kashyapji and Bhante go on a visit to Kalimpong, up in on the borders of Sikkim. And only 3 weeks later, Kashyapji leads Bhante with the words, "Stay here and work for the good of the Dharma. The new hours will look after you." So I'm going to start by giving you an account, some account, a brief account of some of Bhante's adventures in Kalimpong. But this brings us to our first reading about what he saw. So can we have our first reading, please?
And the colours. On account of these alone, Kalimpong would have been a new world. From the blues and purples of the mountains to the reds and yellows of the flowers in the Nepali women's hair, they were all preternaturally vivid, as in a pre-Raphaelite painting. Sometimes, indeed, they glowed with such intensity that everything seemed to be made of jewels. And all the time, above the mirth and the music, above the life and the colour, above the steadfastness of nature and the security of civilization, above everything, there were the snows. On the morning of our arrival, they had been veiled, and we had seen nothing of them. But since then, they had shone forth every day, and often for the whole day. With the blue of the valleys at their feet, and the blue of the sky above their heads, the shimmering white masses stretched from end to end of the horizon, majestic beyond belief. Since the building where Kashyapji and I were staying faced north, we had an uninterrupted view of Mount Kanchenjunga, the second highest peak in the entire Himalayan range, and the third highest in the world. In the early morning, it was particularly beautiful. Looking out of the window just before dawn, I would see it glimmering ghostly in the blue twilight, more like ice than snow. Then, as the sun started rising, the bluish tip of the summit would be flushed by the fiery pink that, in a matter of minutes, had travelled all the way down the peak. Soon the whole range would be a mass of pink embers glowing against the pale blue sky. Pink would change to crimson, crimson to apricot, apricot to the purest, brightest gold. Finally, as the sun cleared the horizon, gold would change to silver, and silver to dazzling white. On particularly fine days, the mountain wore a white plume, almost like a plume of smoke.
So yes, Bhante goes on to say that he felt that the mountain was speaking to him, Kanchenjunga was speaking to him. He didn't know what Kanchenjunga was saying to him, but he thought that if he waited long enough, he would understand. So at this point he says, He gives his first public talk in the area. And he's rudely condemned by an Indian Christian for not only losing faith, but leading others astray. And he remarks, "In the coming months, I was to lead more and more people astray." And then he quotes a little verse. "Behind me, the old gate shuts. Before me opens a new gate of gold." And he explains what he means by this. Up to this point, he's been concerned mostly for himself with receiving ordination. That having been done, and now having settled in Kalimpong, he's able to start thinking of others. So the old gate is selfhood, if you like. The new gate is serving others rather than just himself. And he begins to tell us, he begins to talk about some of his friends. He discovers, he makes friends with an enormous variety of people. Well, some of them are friends, some of them are frankly enemies. And he gives wonderful, vivid descriptions of them. One quite constant friend during this period, and he is mostly a friend, is Colonel Swail Ryan. This gentleman, this very British gentleman, who stays with them for a while, with Bantick for a while, he's described as the intermediary between Bantick and Kalimpong high society. And one of the people that Swail Ryan introduces Bantick to is the subject of our second reading. She is none other than Princess Pema Sedun, or Kukula, as she was popularly called, the eldest daughter of the Maharaja of Sikkim. So, now for our second reading.
"Not many people took advantage of Swail's offer to come and visit me. Most preferred to talk about me without knowing me. One of those who did take advantage of it, and who came to see me not once but several times, was Princess Pema Sedun, the eldest daughter of the Maharaja of Sikkim. In Sarnath, she had been wearing a European-style frock when I'd first seen her. When she appeared at the Dharmodaya Vihara, it was in the full glory of Tibetan traditional costume, at its richest and most elegant. It was as if a beautiful and exotic butterfly had suddenly fluttered across my path. She possessed four qualities which are hardly ever found in one woman: beauty, charm, intelligence, and vitality. She possessed all of them to a higher degree than they often have when present separately. Moreover, all four qualities found expression in even her smallest actions, whether it was the quizzical way she looked up at one from under her long lashes, or slowly exhaled the smoke of a cigarette, or murmured a few words in her low, clear, musical voice. As if these things were not enough, they were perfectly set off by the splendid costume she wore, and by the unshakable self-confidence that came from her consciousness that royal blood flowed in her veins. The total effect was subtly devastating."
So there we are, Princess Pema Sedun, or Kukula, as she was known by her friends and those more distant from her. A little bit more about her. She was interested in tantras, in the beautiful painted images of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And apparently there was a sale of these artifacts in Kalimpong. And she goes to see this and discovers that after talking with the salesman, the person who's selling them, that they have been stolen from one of the great Tibetan lamas who was imprisoned by the Chinese and murdered, so she refuses to buy any. So to balance that rather delightful picture of a gorgeous butterfly, we have now one a male member of that exotic species. He's called Sachin, one of Bhante's longer time friends who he meets quite soon after arriving in Kalimpong and who accompanies him on various more distant travels. So now we're going to have a reading about Sachin.
Years later, in a book by Rumor Godden called Black Narcissus, I encountered a character who, in respect of his effect upon other people, reminded me very much of Sachin when I first met him. The character in question is a young Nepalese prince whose family sends him to a European school in the green, jungle-clad foothills of the eastern Himalayas, somewhere near Darjeeling. With his beauty and his charm, he appears to the nuns who have started the school and who are trying to make a success of the venture to be the very incarnation of the spirit of the hills, the dangerous pagan spirit they are seeking to overcome with their Christian teaching. Every day, the young prince arrives at the school wearing a different coat of colourful silk brocade, each one more dazzling than the last. Sachin was not a prince, and he did not wear coats of colourful silk brocade. But from the effect he produced when he appeared at the Vihara, he might just as well have done. Once again, it was as if a beautiful and exotic butterfly had fluttered across my path. Or rather, this time, it was as if the butterfly was fluttering along the path with me, now alighting on my hand, now alighting on my shoulder, and now dancing on ahead of me down the small sunlit track bordered with brilliant orange marigolds and multicoloured zinnias. With a beauty and a charm that in his case did not need to be set off by a splendid costume or by the consciousness of distinguished social position, Sachin too appeared to be the very incarnation of the spirit of the hills. It was the spirit of the hills that fluttered along the path with me and danced on ahead down the sunlit track. For was not the butterfly, according to the ancients, the symbol of the psyche, the soul? And could there not be a soul or spirit of a place as well as of a person? This spirit, the spirit of the hills, was not dangerous and pagan, as Rumor Godden's nuns believed, or rather, it was dangerous only when thwarted, and pagan only in the sense of being the source of life and joy.
So those are two of Bhante's acquaintances. Rather fascinating. Bhante has a lovely way of painting a picture of these people, very vivid, very interesting, very inspiring in many cases, disturbing when the picture that he paints is of someone not so attractive in a spiritual sense as we find in some of the cases, some of the people that he describes. Bhante meets Dr. George Roerich. For those of you who are interested in art may be familiar with the name. He was the son of the Russian artist Nicholas Roerich. They both painted rather fascinating, rather beautiful pictures. Dr. George Roerich, the son, was a rather strange man. He wore riding breeches, apparently, all the time. And apparently this was because he believed that the king of Shambhala was a mythical figure, was liable to arrive at any time, liable to turn up and take his followers with him, and his followers had to be prepared to mount their horses and go off with him. So then the rainy season begins, and Bhante decides to spend time in the Dharmadaya Vihara. We learn of Newar Buddhist corruption. We learn of Bhante's impecuniousness. He has very little money indeed, and he has somehow he needs money to publish his publication called Stepping Stones. He starts producing a little pamphlet which he wants to sell as widely as possible, to have read as widely as possible, and he needs a certain amount of money for that. So that's just one example. So one of the first contributors, to the first edition of Stepping Stones is Prince Peter of Greece, another extraordinary figure that Bhante meets. And Bhante himself speaks of having ideas like beautiful iridescent balls high in the air that he wants to bring down to earth. And when I first read this many, many years ago, because I've been reading this book for the second time recently, I thought that he was being entirely serious about himself. But I realised on the second reading that he was actually being quite playful about himself, in a way cocking a snoop at himself or laughing at himself mildly, that he should have these strange ideas, like iridescent balls in the sky, and he wanted to bring them down to earth. So we learn, for instance, of Suresh Chandra Jain, who is a despicable liar. Bhante has got an article from one of his contributors that he wants to publish in full in Stepping Stones. And Chandra Jain asks Bhante if he can see the article so that he can publish a little resume in his own publication. So Bhante gives him the copy, and discovers through some of his friends that the man is going to publish the whole thing. So he goes and confronts him, and eventually discovers that yes, indeed, the whole thing has been typeset and is about to be printed. So he goes and calls out this man in the street, and calls him to his face a despicable liar, and apparently berates him in this way for some time. And the young employees of this man stand outside laughing. They rather like the fact that their employer has been taken down a step or two. But this man apparently became a bitter enemy of Bhante, and spread a rumour that Bhante in fact was a communist spy. Yes, so another friend of Bhante's was an artist called Devayani, and she produced a painting, a rather beautiful painting apparently, showing only half of the Buddha's head. And apparently the Tibetans, of whom there were many in Kalimpong, were shocked by this. They regarded this as a wounding of the body of the Buddha. Extraordinary sort of literalism. One of the things that Bhante did during his time at the Dharmadaya Vihara, which was run by the Newars, the Nepali Newars, was film showing. He wanted to attract people in as many ways as possible. So this was one of his skillful means. And yes, he showed films twice a week, and in this sort of way attracted quite a lot of young people. He also installed a games room with a ping pong table, and that too attracted people. But one of the more serious things that he did at the Dharmadaya Vihara was to set up a school for coaching the local Nepali boys. Apparently there were all boys, I think, but I'm not certain about this, coaching them to pass their exams, because of course, well, this was their way to freedom, to pass the exam, to get qualifications. Not that they were interested really in what they were studying. They weren't interested in education for its own sake. They just wanted qualifications so that they could get a job. And apparently the teachers, the local teachers, were very, very bad. They hardly gave any instruction at all. And the only way to get through your exams was to actually employ your teacher to coach you in the evening. So Bansi managed to provide an alternative for this. He provided free teaching for the local boys to help them pass their exams. Yes. So apparently this made Bansi very popular amongst the parents of the local of the boys, of course. They were very, very happy that Bansi was doing this. Another character that we're introduced to in Kalimpong is Joe. Colonel Swale is one of them. Joe is another. They're the two Westerners who come to stay at the Vihara. And apparently they don't get on at all well. Their relationship is characterised by mutual antipathy, Bansi says. Another visitor to the Dhammadaya Vihara is Kamala Shila. Kamala Shila is a monk. Apparently has no interest in Buddhism really, but he is useful because he travels around and is very happy to distribute stepping stones. Another contributor to stepping stones is Lama Govinda. I don't know whether Lama Govinda means anything to you, but he was a very, very popular writer during the 1960s, when people began to be interested in Eastern matters. And so Bansi became in fact very great friends with Lama Govinda. Bansi meets many Mr. Lamas, and he discovered that Mr. Lama doesn't mean that you are a Lama, it's just a surname. Bansi set up a YMBA, a Young Men's Buddhist Association, in Kalimpong. And he acquires a branch in Ajmer, which is in India, northern India, quite a bit further south from Kalimpong, actually. So his activities begin to expand. He speaks of Buddhism as the path of the higher evolution, he says. And he's rather surprised. He doesn't know where this idea has come from. And it's another 20 years, apparently, before he starts thinking of this idea again. And those of you who listen to Bansi's talks will have discovered something about his teaching of the higher evolution. He also at this time gets a letter from Dr. Ambedkar. Again, this name surely means something to you, the man who inaugurates the great mass conversion to Buddhism in 1956. So it's come to Dr. Ambedkar's notice that Bansi has started the Young Men's Buddhist Association in Kalimpong, and he says that a great responsibility lies on the shoulders of the bhikkhus if this attempt at the revival of Buddhism is to be a success. They must be more active than they have been. They must come out of their shell and be in the first rank of the fighting forces. This is a typical rousing sort of language of Dr. Ambedkar at the time. He says, "I'm glad you have started the YMBA in Kalimpong, but you should be even more active than that." Yes. So then misfortune arrives in the form of a monk called the Venerable Aniruddha. He is irascible. He's angry for no apparent reason. And Bansi has to deal with him. More about that later. Then an interesting and important thing happens. Bansi gets an invitation from Venerable Sangharatna, who he's already met in India, to attend the 19th anniversary celebrations of the opening of the Mulaganda Puti Vihara, which is the Vihara established by Anagarika Dharmapala, the great Ceylonese Buddhist. And so Bhante is very, very happy about that and has a delightful time. Then, 10 months, only 10 months after arriving in Kalimpong in 1950, Bhante leaves for Sarnath and the higher ordination. Yeah? He's been wanting to be ordained as a fully qualified, as it were, a fully accepted Buddhist monk. He's had his lower ordination, or Sramanera ordination, from Chandramani in Kusinara. Now he wants to become a fully ordained Buddhist monk. So he gives us a very full account of this ordination, and he says that he has feelings of deep satisfaction, quite unparalleled. He's never felt so fully accepted, and his ambition, his wish to be fully accredited, as it were, fully ordained monk, is fulfilled. Whilst he's in Sarnath, he meets another interesting character, a person who he describes as the old, brilliant, gentle and unassuming Professor Surendranath Dasgupta. And also he meets the young, intellectually arrogant Professor Herbert Gunter. So he paints some quite vivid pictures of these two personalities, who are, well, quite known for those who read in depth in Buddhist literature. Back he goes after ordination as now Bhikkhu Sangharakshita to Kalimpong, and he has a shock awaiting him at the Dharmadaya Vihara. The monk, the angry monk Aniruddha, has nailed wooden boards across the recreation hut entrance. Students have been told that they're not wanted. Aniruddha had moved into Bhante's room and simply thrown all his belongings down into the stairwell where they lay scattered about. Really quite a shocking thing to discover on his return. Anyway, Bhante installed himself in a downstairs room, and not long after, Aniruddha banged on the door. If Bhante wanted to stay in the Vihara, he said, he'd have to pay 100 rupees a month, otherwise he could clear out. So, of course, this was not the sort of behaviour that Bhante had expected from a fellow bhikkhu, but there we are. Bhante took advice from the police officers, because he was actually threatened with violence by Aniruddha. And, of course, the question arose, well, where should he go if he couldn't stay in this Vihara? And one of the people that he got to know during his first 10 months there was Burma Raja. Who was Burma Raja? Burma Raja was the nephew of King Tibor of Burma. He was actually, Burma Raja, so-called, was actually Prince Lutakin. He was a prince of the Burmese royal lineage. And he has a little unused cottage in his garden where he's now living. So this cottage is offered to Bhante by Burma Raja. And he has very, very interesting conversations with Burma Raja about the conditions obtaining in the Burmese royal family, including the trampling of unwanted or suspected relatives who were tied up and put in special purple velvet bags imported from Europe somewhere and trampled on by elephants to the sound of trumpets. Yes, rather yes, strange happenings in Burma. Anyway, the question, of course, Bhante had now his own accommodation in Kalimpong, but what about the YMBA? What about all those activities that he wanted to continue with? Well, he found that there were 6 godowns, as they used to be called, or warehouse, little warehouses or places where you could deposit your goods in central Kalimpong. 6 godowns, side by side. So he rented these and re-established the YMB there. Meanwhile, apparently, Stepping Stones, his little magazine, continued to appear regularly with contributors Lama Govinda and Professor Gunter, the arrogant young professor of philosophy, and especially, of course, an expert in Tibetan Vajrayana literature. Swale and Joe and their enmity is a bit of a problem, and Bhante has to decide, well, can they both stay if they create such a bad atmosphere? And eventually, with some reluctance, he asks Swale to go, because Joe, at that time, seems to be the more sincere of them and the more willing to help with the YMBA. Bhante talks of meeting at this time with the Hindu census officer. This is 1951, and a census is being made in India, and the census officer arrives, and Bhante explains that he's a Buddhist, but the census officer says, no, you're completely wrong, you are a Hindu of the Buddhist caste. So Bhante remonstrates with him, but it's no use. His remonstrations fall on deaf ears. As far as the Hindu census officer is concerned, he's a Hindu of the Buddhist caste. The next important thing that happens is the sacred relics of Moggallana and Shariputra have been discovered by one of the early British excavators, and these sacred relics are going to be taken on tour and displayed for the edification of the faithful. And Bhante is appointed general secretary of this whole sort of project. And so with the help of various people, these sacred relics are displayed in Kalimpong. Bhante arranges, a big procession, and they're also taken to further afield. They're taken, in fact, to eventually to Tibet, and Bhante, of course, is delighted at the prospect of going to Tibet. But much to his disappointment, when he applies for a visa, he's told that it won't be possible, because apparently the instructions came directly from Pandit Nehru, that nobody was allowed to be no foreigner was to be allowed into Tibet under any pretext. Of course, Bhante is deeply disappointed and rather puzzled at this idea, at any pretext, as if he would be going to Tibet on a pretext. He would simply be going to Tibet, of course, as himself, as a Buddhist monk. At this point, Bhante has some thoughts on the relics themselves, because he's been, helping the relics to be displayed, and tens of thousands of people have been, deeply inspired by them, and in fact, apparently, he and Sangharatna have been, one of their duties has been to lift up the relics in a tray and place them on the head of the faithful person. They've done this tens of thousands of times. So now we're going to have a reading about Bhante's thoughts on the relics.
I was not so clear about my own personal attitude towards the sacred relics, which was in fact rather ambivalent. I was deeply touched by the simple faith and unaffected piety of the people who, every day, came to pay their respect to the sacred relics. And I could even empathize with that faith and that piety. At the same time, I was quite unable to feel towards the sacred relics the kind of devotion that they so evidently felt. For one thing, I was not even sure that the tiny fragments of bone lying at the bottom of the capsules really had belonged to Shariputra and Mudgalyana. True, they had been discovered by General Cunningham in stupa number 3 at Sanchi, and there seemed no reason to doubt that the inscriptions on the steatite boxes in which he had found them were in Brahmi characters of the time of Ashoka. But how could one be sure that these same fragments of bone really were the relics of the two arhats, as the builders of the stupa apparently believed?
Yes, so Bhante has many more adventures in the north, in the area around Kalimpong and Sikkim. We haven't time, unfortunately, to explore those. I now want to mention quite briefly his activities during the latter part of his period as a monk in India, where he begins to visit the plains. He goes down from Kalimpong and begins to meet the untouchables. And the people who are right outside the caste system in India, and starts communicating the Dharma to them. And of course they are delighted that a Western monk, someone who really knows the Dharma, is explaining it to them. Bhante meets also Dr. Ambedkar. He meets him on 3 occasions in all, and the last occasion on which he meets Dr. Ambedkar is as a result of his being part of the 2500th anniversary of the enlightenment of the Buddha Jayanti as it's called. He is invited to participate in what are called eminent Buddhists from the border regions. What Bhante is regarded as an eminent Buddhist from the border regions. So a whole little band of them are conducted around various places, during part of this tour they all go and meet Dr. Ambedkar, who by this time of course has inaugurated the mass conversion in Nagpur in 1956. And Bhante talks of his last meeting with Ambedkar, who was by now a very ill man, and how he's sitting in the sun and very, very hot, and Bhante feels that he shouldn't be, he should be in the shade, but Ambedkar insists on talking to Bhante under those conditions. And he's obviously very, very ill and very weary, and wants, it seems, to sort of put on Bhante's shoulders the part of the burden of looking after all his millions, as there now are, his millions of followers. So yes, let's just share the last, I think I can find quite quickly, the last reading of that meeting with Dr. Ambedkar, because it's rather important. He was a deeply worried man. The movement of mass conversion had been successfully inaugurated. But what of the future? There was still so much to be done. From the way he spoke, sitting there with arms resting on the table and lowered head, it was clear that the weight of his responsibilities had become almost too much for him to bear, and that he wanted to transfer some of that weight to younger shoulders. Indeed, I had the distinct impression that the shoulders to which he wanted to transfer some of it were my own. Be that as it may, the meeting was undoubtedly tiring him. The broken sentences came from his lips with increasing difficulty and at ever longer intervals. Eventually, when his head was already resting on his outstretched arms, his eyes closed in utter weariness. Whereupon, to his doctor wife's evident relief, we all quietly left. So, I think at this point I'm just going to have to wrap things up. It seems such a pity in a way that we have such a short time to talk about these things. But I'd just like to recommend these two volumes of Bhante's memoirs to you. The first called Facing Mount Kanchenjunga, and the second in the sign of the golden wheel. They're very, very rich in anecdote, rich in insights of all kinds, and very, very exciting, very, very absorbing to read. So I can thoroughly recommend them to you, and that really is the best way to get, you know, an idea of what Bhante did during those 20 years in India, or certainly the latter 14 years as a monk, as a fully ordained monk. And some you get some idea, of course, of the stature of our teacher, if you haven't already done so. He was a quite extraordinary man. Long before the hippie trail had started, there he was in India, going from door to door with a begging bowl, practicing as a Buddhist, and learning what the spiritual life was really all about. So I hope that I've managed to give you a wee. Thank you to the readers. Have been able to give you some idea of that period of Bhante's life.
Thank you.